Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you, whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita. Ron is not here today.
And I'm Jean Marie. This week's topic may be especially upsetting for some listeners and may not be appropriate for young listeners. Parental discretion is advised. Today we will be talking about suicide and other mental health conditions. If you or somebody you know is in a suicidal crisis, or if you or someone you know is thinking about ending your life or their life, please seek immediate help. In most areas here in the United States, you can dial 911 or 1-800-273-8255. Again, that number is 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-TALK.
And collectively, we're the host of Podcast DX. On today's show, we're talking about mental health, suicide, and funny enough, comedy with Frank King. Frank is a former Frank is a former writer for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. He's joining us today after floating around looking for a port that would accept passengers from a very recent trip to Hong Kong at the start of the coronavirus. Heck, that could have been a show right there. Hello, Frank. Thank you for joining us today. And I guess that you have developed a new term for the seasickness, huh?
Yeah, no, actually, I've written quite a bit of comedy that I cannot do on the ship about our voyage, for example. Ladies and gentlemen, yeah, welcome to the Glove Boat, G-L-O-V-E.
Glove Boat. There you go.
Yeah, so you've heard of booze cruises. It's the world's first booze cruise. Thank you.
Oh, goodness gracious.
My wife said, bring home a 12-pack of Corona. I said, not to worry, honey. I'm bringing home a case. Thank you.
You would be a hit at the CDC's next convention.
Yes. You got to do that.
Yes. If you're old enough to remember the Love Boat, my bartender is sick. Oh. And, I said to my wife, don't worry, I always have a shot with my Corona.
Frank. Oh, that's rough, though. That's got to be rather stressful.
And you're still on the ship, is that right?
Yes, I'm employed by the ship to do stand-up comedy. And I did 4 shows while I was on here, 2 seatings of dinner, 2 different nights. And remarkable shows, given, you know, all that was going on. The pastors had an amazing attitude. I mean, some were depressed, some were distressed, some were posting on Facebook that, you know, that they were abandoned. And you're trapped, yes, but you're on a luxury cruise boat, right? For goodness sakes, get a grip.
Right. I mean, the food was still good.
And there's a current show on HBO called Avenue 5 that's all about a cruise in space that just keeps going and going. And definitely another...
Yeah, I've got it on my watch list.
Okay.
Well, Frank, mental health is something we all should be talking about, obviously. And could you tell us why you focus specifically on mental health in your amazing TED Talk, stand-up comedy, and other work?
Yes, and by the way, Owen, for you and for your listeners, I want to apologize. Even with a cell phone this far away, there's a slight, like, one second and a half delay. So if the listeners are thinking, why are they talking over each other? That's so rude. It's the satellite delay.
Well, you're doing pretty good. And so far, according to my graph, I think we're okay. And if not, our editor can make the adjustments.
Yep. Thanks, Jack, for Dominic.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, yeah, as I said, they can do magic in post, post-production. Let's back up just a second, because that is that's sort of the key to a question that I get frequently when I speak, and I usually address it with the audience immediately. They say, okay, let me get this straight. A stand-up comedian talking about depression and suicide, how does that work? And what I tell them is, I began as a stand-up comic in 1985, the day after Christmas. I went on the road with my girlfriend, then now my lovely wife. We were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop, no home, just post office box answering service, and opened up for and lived with Foxworthy and Ron White and Ellen DeGeneres and Dennis Miller and Dana Carvey and Kevin Nealon and Kevin James and Adam Sandler. Anyway, that's the start of my comedy career.
Wow.
That's why, and I've been doing that full time for 34 years. And And I was on all the shows in the last century, comedy shows that had a brick wall. You meet the Improv, Showtime's Comedy Club Network. And my claim to fame, by the way, is I said this in a television and a radio interview back in the U.S. from the ship. I said, look, I'm a comedian. This whole ship thing is not the worst thing that's ever happened to me. On the old Star Search with Ed McMahon, I lost to a puppet.
Oh, no. Oh gosh. Oh.
I remember Star Search.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's the genesis of my comedy career. I started in high school as a talent show, always wanted to be a comedian, funny since the fourth grade. And then the reason that I'm qualified or I'm a good choice to talk about depression, thoughts of suicide, is that it runs in my family. It's called generational depression and suicide. And my grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. And if you've seen my TED Talks, you know my great aunt died by suicide, my mother, and I found her. I was 4 years old. I'll spare your listeners the gory details, but It's in my first TED Talk called A Matter of Laugh or Death. And I was 4 years old. And if you are already hardwired for generational depression and suicide, and you're that close to an actual suicide, as I was at four, then the chance of you thinking about or attempting to take your life go up a couple of notches.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't diagnosed. I was depressed in college, high school, best 3 years of my life. When I tell a joke, I say best 6 years of my life. had a great time in high school and then went to college, and my girlfriend, who eventually became my first wife, and I'm not going to run my first wife down unless, of course, I kick her in my headlights. Kidding. Wonderful one. We should have never gotten married, but you know what they say, opposites attract. She was pregnant, I wasn't. When I went to college, she went to University of Arizona. I went to Chapel Hill. UNT Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought I was lovesick. I didn't realize. And looking back now, I believe I was, that was the first time in my life I was truly clinically depressed.
Okay.
And so we survived college. I survived college. We got married. As I said, it was a mistake. She's a wonderful woman. We should never have gotten married. But I got married. And then a year or so into the marriage, and this is my fourth TEDx talk, I realized I was depressed and suicidal. And if I didn't do something, I was selling church, which I didn't want to be doing. I was married to this lovely woman, but we didn't belong together. And I wasn't going to open mic night, which I knew was where I belonged. And my thought was, I'm going to kill myself sooner rather than later. So that empowered me, because the second thought was, well, I could quit my job, you know, divorce my wife, try comedy. If it works, great. If it doesn't, hey, I can still kill myself.
Yeah.
So, and that was when I had my first suicidal thoughts, was during that period. I remember driving down Highway 163 in San Diego. It was kind of a rainy afternoon. It was about 5 o'clock, the lowest point in my day, generally, is about that time of day. And for the first time ever, that thought flitted across my mind. Well, why don't you just kill yourself? I'm like, whoa, where'd that come from?
Mm-hmm.
So we got divorced. I started comedy. Met my lovely second wife, who's wonderful, far too good looking for me. Thank God for low self esteem. And did the comedy thing. Did amateur night for a year or so, and then did that, went on the road with her for 7 years. Came off the road to some radio back in Raleigh, my hometown, North Carolina. I took a number one morning.
Love Raleigh, Durham area.
Drove to number six. Yeah, that's where my family is.
Okay.
So I took a number one morning radio show and drove to number six in 18 months and got fired. Still not depressed, because I'm doing comedy. I'm married to a wonderful woman. You know, life is pretty good. The thing is, not depressed constantly. What I found was that I was most depressed and most suicidal at some of the best times in my life, because I have a condition called chronic suicidal ideation.
Okay.
Which means two things. One, it's generally not situational, although the situation can trigger it. Well, I'll tell you about that in a second. And two, it's one of those things that sort of lies dormant in between. Here's my example. For me and people like me who have chronic suicidal ideation, and some of your listeners may have this and not even realize it has a name. They probably just think they're some kind of freak. It happens to me when I keynote, at least one person comes up after every show, sometimes more than one, and they've got chronic suicidal ideation. and they had no idea how his name. They just felt like some kind of freak, and their relief is palpable when they realize that they're not alone. Mm-hmm. Anyway, here's how it works. For me, suicide is always an option as a solution for a problem large or small. And when I say small, and I tell the audience this, my car broke down a couple of years ago, and I had three thoughts unbidden. One, get it fixed. Two, buy a new one. Three, I could just kill myself. That's chronic suicidal ideation.
Okay.
So, I always worried, you know, I'm this depressed when things are good. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen when things go bad, really bad? And that happened in the recession. In 2008, early 2009, my speaking comedy business dropped off 80%. My wife and I lost everything we'd worked for in 25 years in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And I came close enough to dying by suicide that I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like.
Okay.
So I think that qualifies me to speak. And I've taken some training. It's called QPR, Queen Paul Romeo, QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer. If you go to QPRinstitute.com,
okay,
you can read all about it.
Okay.
It's what they call gatekeeper training. I'm trained to teach people how to spot signs of depression, thoughts, and suicide, what to say, what not to say, what to do, what not to do. And I've also taken mental health first aid and something called Working Minds, which is suicide prevention as a workplace health and safety issue. So in addition to having what they call lived experience, mm-hmm, I've also got, you know, some book learning, as we used to say down. So I got some book learning. and when I speak, I can give them solid takeaways, action items. Mm-hmm. So that's what I tell the audience. That's what makes me qualified.
Right. Do you think that people are more willing to open up to you based on the history that you've got and the fact that you share so openly with them?
Yes, absolutely. Great question. Because when I tell the audience, I came close enough to dying by suicide that I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like. The 20 or 25% of people in the audience who have a mental illness of some kind, diagnosed, undiagnosed, treated, untreated, realize instantly that I get it. And because I'm on stage for two reasons. One, to let these people, the people who have mental illness, know I get it. I feel their pain. And two, to help the neuronormal people, the 75% of the audience, understand the thought processes behind depression, thoughts of suicide.
Right.
When I say to the audience, I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like, my first joke is, spoiler alert, I didn't pull the trigger. Nervous laugh.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I say, look, a friend of mine came up to me after a keynote like last month, and he'd never heard me say that. And he said this, and I quote, "Hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger?" I go, "Hey, man, could you try to sound a little less disappointed?"
Yeah, wow.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Big laugh.
Yeah.
And there's a psychological principle that if you have something really serious to tell or teach someone, if you can follow it up with something that's a little lighter, a little comic relief, then they're more mentally prepared for the next chunk of serious.
Okay.
And it helps them retain more.
Okay. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, like that cushion
and
of comfort.
To your question, generally one person, sometimes half a dozen or more, what I do is I say, look, we'll do a general Q&A when I'm done. Mm-hmm. And then if you have a question you would like to ask me or a story you would like to share that you don't want to do in front of everybody else, then I'll just hang out and I'll chat with everybody who wants to chat. And usually it's 1, 2, 3, 4, sometimes 6, 7 people. And some have chronic suicidal ideation. Some just have questions about a loved one who died by suicide, you know, because I went and looked into the abyss and came back. Their loved one did not. So here's the upshot of all that, by the way. I had an epiphany in January of 2019. I just finished an engagement at the University of Montana Billings, a college suicide prevention keynote. And I'm standing outside, it's dusk, it's starting to snow, and I'm thinking about all these people that have come up to me after my keynotes, many of whom have what I have and are now relieved to know they're not alone. And maybe I steered them just far enough off the path of suicide that they'll live a normal life. And as I'm thinking about all these people whose lives I've perhaps changed in that small way, it hit me. I am George Bailey in the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay.
I've been shown what these people's lives would be like if I were not there to speak and let them know they're not alone. And my second thought was, oh my God, now I can't kill myself because I take all these people with me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there you go. Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, and even if it's that thought that gets you through.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've been doing all the talking, guys. I'm like a pole start lawnmower. You know, you pull my cord, I run out of gas. So you guys probably have a question or two.
I do. Frank, how common is suicide?
Well, one person dies of suicide in the U.S. every 11 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's an old number. That was the 2018 number.
Right. Okay.
And I know that suicide has recently, I don't know if the trend has changed or if we're just noticing it, but gotten younger and younger. Have you noticed that, or have you learned anything about that as far as age?
Well, the couple things. Number one, you suspect that the loneliest group of people in the United States, well, let me ask you, who do you think the loneliest group of people are?
I would have thought elderly.
Yeah.
No.
No, huh?
It's teenage girls.
Teenage girls, okay.
Teenage girls.
So all the Snapchat and the Facebook and the Instagram and Twitter, that's just not really connecting people because it's so distant, right?
Yes, we are the most connected and disconnected generations of people in the history of the world. What's happening with teenagers, and I've got an actual keynote on digital media addiction. Mm-hmm. There's not yet a connection between digital media and self-reported major depressive disorder and thoughts of suicide. It may just be a correlation. It's certainly not a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening with young people is, because of the smartphone, mm-hmm. and like I said, Facebook and so forth, the number is, since 2012 to today, teenagers are spending 40% less FaceTime, not the Facebook app, but mm-hmm. FaceTime, in other words, face-to-face time, with their peers. Like when we were kids, we hung out on the corner, we hung out at the mall. So since 2012, that number of the amount of time that kids spend with other kids in person has dropped 40%. And so they think that is part of the problem is, you know, having your face in a phone and not being face-to-face with your peers.
Sure.
So there's been a spike in self-reported teenage major depressive disorder, and there's a spike in teenage suicide rates. And if you look at if you took the graph of smartphone ownership, which, by the way, in the U.S., in 2012, the number of people who had smartphones crossed the 50% mark. Mm-hmm. Half the people in the U.S. have smartphones. And it's up around 78 or 79% now. If you took that graph and you overlaid it with a graph of self-reported teenage major depressive disorder, the graph lines, they would just basically cover one another. And then if you put on top of that graph a graph of teenage rates of suicide, it also pretty much overlays that upward line.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all those three things are basically the same in terms of growth. If you did it on a graph.
Mm-hmm.
And now this,
so it can't be a coincidence.
Right.
What is the connection? I don't know. But there may be there obviously is a correlation.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Absolutely. Frank, for what you're doing every day, opening up conversations and bringing awareness about suicide and mental health to people that are, you know, typically not talking about it. I mean, it's typically a taboo subject. What do you advise or what could you suggest to our listeners so that they could, you know, be more like you and be more open and be more receptive to other people that might be in a crisis and might need to just have somebody to listen?
Well, and that's, by the way, what my clients pay me to do. And I've heard it from them over and over and over. We brought you in to start the conversation on suicide. Because you watch my TED Talk, you know I say, when I was writing this TED Talk and talking to people about depression and suicide, I realized that nobody talks about it, even though one person dies every 11 minutes. However, I found out that if you mention the words depression and suicide out loud, people will tell you the most amazing things, some of whom people I've just met. It's like they're waiting for somebody to utter the magic, or in this case, the tragic words, depression and suicide, to give voice to their feelings and experiences. Once I open the conversation, And that's what people bring me in to do. I teach people gatekeeper training with QPR is basically what you're asking. Mm-hmm. How do you start the conversation on suicide? And here's why it's so important. And I'll give your listeners some takeaways on doing this. It's important because 8 out of 10 people, roughly, who are contemplating suicide are ambivalent. They want someone to say something.
As far as like, you mean like stop? Do you want, you think they want somebody to say, just stop and think about it, or
topic, or notice that they're suffering?
Yeah. Or is it all?
Yeah, noticing is, and that's what I teach.
Notice, okay.
You know, how do you notice? And then what do you say? What don't you say? What do you do? What don't you do?
Okay.
Because 2 out of 10 people, by the way, and I was one of them, I wasn't going to reach out to anybody. I was just going to go ahead and kill myself. I had time, place, and method. I didn't, because you've seen my TED Talk, whereas my insurance wasn't fully enforced. My wife would have gotten nothing. And if I waited 2 months, she'd get $1 billion. So because I have chronic suicidality and I'm always willing to do it, I know I can do it anytime I like, I'd wait in 2 months. Okay, I can do that. And then I can kill myself, you know, in 2 months and a day. And by the way, that's another misnomer or misperception of why people die by suicide. Friends of mine, acquaintances say, why did so-and-so want to kill themselves? And I tell you, chances are so-and-so didn't want to kill themselves. They just wanted to end the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew in two months and a day, hell, I could do it. I've been able to do it all my life.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, my book, when I write it, and I've got the title and the cover and the subtitle done, it's going to be called Starting a Conversation on Suicide, Living in the Exit Row. And on the cover is a picture of a guy sitting in the exit row on a plane staring out the window, because that's where I sit.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about 8 out of 10 people are ambivalent. Okay, that's number one. Number two, 9 out of 10 people who are thinking about suicide give hints in the week leading up to the attempt, either direct, indirect, verbal, nonverbal, or behavioral hints. So we'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
So if you can, you always hear people say, I had no idea. You're the happiest guy in the world. Blah, blah, blah. How come I didn't notice? Well, you didn't notice because you didn't know what it looked like. So let's talk about that.
Okay.
If that's okay with you guys.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, here, listeners, as my professors used to say, this is going to be on the exam.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Pay attention. You're supposed to, what do they do in the Army? They'd stamp their foot. They would stamp their foot in the Army when they would be talking about something that they wanted you to remember, because you're taught all kinds of stuff. But if it was something that was critical, they'd stamp their foot during the lecture, and you know, hey, that's going to be on the test.
Right. And you're far more likely to come across somebody who needs mental health support than you will ever come across somebody that needs something like CPR. So this is definitely something we're
trying to focus on.
Right. So please, you have the floor.
Yes. Or actually, you have the poop deck.
Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
The poop deck. Yeah, no, we still have power, so there is no poop deck.
Okay.
The correlation, by the way, and the QPR folks make this correlation. QPR is like CPR.
Mm-hmm.
In that, with CPR, the sooner you realize somebody's having a heart attack, the sooner you begin pumping their chest, the sooner you get the AED, you know, those battery-operated paddles, and the sooner you get the EMTs there to take over, the better the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And QPR is the same way. The sooner you notice something is off, the sooner you have that conversation, and I'll tell you how to have it, and the sooner you get them stabilized in a safe place, and the sooner you get them to a mental health professional, the better the outcome. That's the connection between CPR and QPR. And when I learned my course in Seattle, Washington, is the place to have a heart attack, because 1 in 4 people in Seattle is trained in CPR.
Oh, wow.
So my goal and the goal of the QPR Institute is to have 1 in 4 people in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
trained on QPR. And so, and children, here's your first lesson. How do you spot signs of depression? Well, here's a couple of hints. And by the way, if they want to know more, there's a very inexpensive way to learn. It's called mentalhealthfirstaid.com. And they have an 8-hour course.
Okay, and we'll have a link for that on our website.
Yeah, mentalhealthfirstaid.com. I think it's .com. And they have a course for adults, a course for children. They're developing a course for seniors. And it's an 8-hour class. They toss in lunch, and it can cost you anything from $0 to $25. I mean, it's nominally priced. So how do you spot signs of depression? Well, here's a couple signs. One, can't eat too much, can't sleep too much. Has trouble getting up in the morning, but rallies in the afternoon. And this is one that you could, it's one you can see. It's they let their personal hygiene go. If they were always, you know, wearing clean clothes and hair washed and, you know, put together, I teach dental suicide prevention for the practice. And I say, look, if you got a patient who comes in and, you know, every time they saw you every 6 months, they were all put together, you know, hair was clean. And they come and they look like they haven't bathed in a day or two and they're wearing dirty clothes and they've let their dental hygiene go. That's a really dangerous. I mean, that may be because when you're that depressed, sometimes getting out of bed, taking a shower, brushing your teeth is just, here's the metaphor I use. Neuronormal people don't understand that having a mental illness is like this. There's a Greek character named Sisyphus. He gave fire to man and his punishment was he had to roll a rock up a hill every day in an attempt to get it over the top. And every day he'd get near the top and the rock would roll back down to the bottom of the hill. And having a mental illness is like that. Every morning you wake up, there's a rock in the hill. Some days the rock is small and the hill is not so steep. Some days the rock is huge, a boulder, and the hill is Everest. But every day there's a rock in the hill. So if they're really depressed, you know, just getting out of bed, brushing your teeth, washing your clothes, showering is a boulder. So that's to look for personal hygiene. Now, I get the question, what do you say to somebody you think is depressed? Here's what you don't say. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Turn that frown upside down. Have you tried fish oil? Because I've heard that a number of times.
Fish oil. Oh, yeah.
My uncle took fish oil and he gave him,
gave up all that other
parts. Apple cider vinegar, right? Oh, yeah. Another cure-all.
Yeah. Or tapping. Or, you know, it's like I get wretchedly seasick. I mean, wretched. I'm the kid who grew up on the Ferris wheel when I was young. I have to take the Dramamine to take a car ferry. The joke I wrote was, if I'm in a meeting and somebody makes a motion, I go, stop, I'm getting nauseous. People have all these, have you tried ginger? Have you tried those bands you wear on your arms? Yes, yes, yes. And I take hardcore anti-nausea medication because I throw up like Lindsay Lohan after a three-day weekend. Okay, so here's what you do say to somebody who you believe, you know, they let their personal hygiene go, you notice they're eating too much, you can't eat, sleep, but can't sleep. You say, I'm here for you and mean it. I know you're not crazy, lazy, or self-absorbed. I know that depression is an illness. But here's the good news. With time and treatment, things will get better. I will take the time. I'll help get treatment and mean it. And then here's the question that everybody, including me, has difficulty asking, but you must ask. And if you can't ask this, you find somebody who can. The question is, are you having thoughts of suicide? Just like that. Now, there's an old urban legend that you should never mention the S word in front of someone who's depressed. And I love the reasoning because it might give them the idea. Wow, suicide. What a great idea. Why did you not think of that? You must ask that question. So that's the protocol. Those are signs and symptoms, not an exhaustive list. And the protocol if you think they're depressed. You still there with me?
Oh yeah. We're actually studying and taking notes because you know you're teaching us. Yes.
Well, and here's the thing that I learned from a corporation that I spoke for. They not only insisted their employees take notice and ask, they insisted that all the employees, if someone said to them, look, I've noticed that you don't seem to be, you know, as chipper as usual, and I've noticed some other things, and I just want to know, you know, are you depressed? The other employee is by company policy mandated to say, thank you for asking. Mm-hmm. So that the person who's going to be asking is not worried about getting harshed on by the person they ask.
Right.
Which I think is brilliant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe the person says, no, we have a new baby. I've slept in three nights. That's why I'm a little off my game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how do you spot signs? Let's say they're not forthcoming that they're having thoughts of suicide. How do you spot it? Okay, here's some signs. They are talking about death and dying, Googling death and dying. Death and dying appears as a theme in their artwork, like their music or their painting or their writing. They're collecting the means to die by suicide, whether it's buying a gun and ammunition or stockpiling medication. They're getting their affairs in order. They're giving away prized possessions because they want to make sure the prized possessions go to the people they want them to go to when they're gone. And here's a counterintuitive one, extremely dangerous. if they've been depressed for a long time and all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, they're happy. And it's dangerous because you're happy, they're happy. They may be happy because they've chosen time, place, and method, and they know, wait for it, we've heard this before, they know the pain is finite. That's why they're happy.
Okay.
Right.
That's a very dangerous. Okay, let's say they are forthcoming. They are having thoughts of suicide. What's the protocol? Well, here it is. If they say, yes, I'm having thoughts of suicide, you say, do you have a plan? And if they say they have a plan, what is your plan? If the plan is detailed, your job as a mental health first responder is to get them on the phone with the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. You gave it out at the top of the show.
Right.
Or if they're a young person, and young people are far more forthcoming in text, they can text the word HELP to 741-741. And there'll be somebody roughly their age on the other end of the phone who is there to counsel them. Now, I suggest adding two questions to that list, because if you said to me, Frank, are you depressed? Oh, yeah, often. Are you having thoughts of suicide? Yeah, because I have chronic suicidal ideation. Do you have a plan? I got half a dozen plans. The next question should be, are you going to kill yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, no, why would I kill myself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have these thoughts all the time. It's not. And then the last question, I believe most important. If they say, no, they're not going to kill themselves, you say, okay, then tell me why not. So you force them to give voice to whatever it is that they believe will keep them alive, whether it's pets or family or kids or friends.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, and in my case, we've already talked about why am I not going to kill myself? Because I'm George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life. And if I did, I'd take all those other people with me.
Right. So it's like active listening, where you are reassuring the other person, but you're allowing them to reassure themselves.
Yes. Listening to them. What do I say to somebody who's depressed? Don't say anything. Just sit and actively listen. And don't say, you know, not all normal people want to help. You know, well, this will pass. Things will get better. You know, here's what you don't say to somebody who you believe is having thoughts of suicide. You're being melodramatic. You're just looking for attention. Nobody who talks about it ever does it. As a matter of fact, it's just the opposite. People who talk about it give hints and such, you know, that last week that they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's really sad for me when somebody says, yeah, I had no idea. You know, why didn't he reach out? And by the way, men tend not to reach out. That's why my two co-authors and I wrote the book that's coming out March 1st.
Oh.
Which is, it's a men's mental health book.
Okay.
A friend of mine teaches suicide prevention to first responders. She teaches QPR, mostly men. And she went to Barnes & Noble and Amazon everywhere looking for a book on men's, specifically on men's mental health. And there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And 8 out of 10 people who die by suicide in the U.S. today are men, age 45 to 54.
Okay.
And so we got together. They got together, two ladies, Dr. Sally Spencer Thomas, who's way up the food chain in suicide prevention. Her brother died by suicide. And Sarah W. Gare, who teaches QPR to first responders. It was her idea. They got together and decided to make it's called Guts, Grit, and the Grind,
okay,
a men's mental mechanics manual. A men's mental mechanics manual.
Okay.
And if you go to gutsgritgrind.com,
mm-hmm,
that's a little website. You can hear the forward. I voiced the forward. I'm going to voice the book for Audible. And it's stories. It's an anthology. It's stories of men who have an issue, by men, in an effort to help men. The first 500 words of their story is, things are great. Second 500 words, things went to hell in a handbasket. Third 500 words, here's how I'm coping, in hopes that a man will pick it up, look at the index, find his problem, and see how another dude is handling the problem. Because men tend to take advice from men.
Okay.
So that's the power of the book. We think a lot of women will buy the book because they've got a man in their life who has an issue, and they'll thumb through the index and see how they can help. Because what happened was, we surveyed some people, surveyed men, asked them their problems, surveyed women, what do you think men's problems are? And although the order the problems weren't the same. The list was basically the same. What women thought men's problems were, what men said men's problems were. Mm-hmm. Now, we then ask them, what kind of help, ask women, what kind of help do you think guys need?
Right.
And then they ask guys, what kind of help do you want? The lists were diametrically opposed.
Oh, no.
Completely different. So, again, that's why we wrote the book. So that a woman could pick it up, see the problem that the man in her life, her dad, her brother, her husband has, mm-hmm. and see how men want to receive help.
Right. Okay. That's great. That's really great. And we'll make sure that we have a link for that on our website, and it'll also be on our Pinterest page as well, so that people can get a hold of that book.
For sure. For sure.
And I will say that in my case, I know that like one of my doctors mentioned before I took a couple handfuls of pills that day I had looked disheveled. And for being someone who is very fastidious to having that written about me, and but no one caught it, but it is something, you know, noticeable. And I just wanted to make that comment as well, that it is important to look for all of those signs you were saying. And it's great if there's a book to go to as well, because you could even say, hey, I've been reading this book and I've been noticing some things, and I, you know, maybe you'd like to talk about it, or we need to talk about it. And it's a great opening gambit for a conversation.
Right.
I took mental health first aid,
right.
And they give you a manual that's chock full of a wide range of mental illnesses and how to spot them and what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, everything from depression, bipolar, schizoaffective to non-lethal self-harm, which teenagers are into, cutting, biting, burning. So that's another way to it's a primer on mental health. You'll be able to spot, you know, it's one of those things where once you learn that kind of thing, you can't not see it mm-hmm. anymore.
Something that I think in teachers should probably be taking as part of their curriculum before they become a teacher, so that they could be aware of their pupils when they're, you know, when the students look like they're having a problem.
Well,
you know,
and actually there is actually computer programs as well that can analyze a student's writing and recognize signs prior to you know, quicker as well. So there's another tool for them.
And I am speaking on the 28th of February in Edmonton, Canada,
mm-hmm.
to the largest teacher association in Canada.
Wow.
And I'm doing two keynotes back to back on this, including a slice of the digital media addiction. So I'm training up as gatekeepers. So
okay, that's great.
You know, the more gatekeepers we have, the more people that can spot it, the better chances for, you know, because people want somebody to notice, and they want somebody to say something so they, you know, they, and trust me, I'm now the permission fairy. If I say the word depression, it's just, if I scream the words depression and suicide in this Lido buffet right now,
mm-hmm.
I bet you three or four people come up and go, I got a story.
Yeah, because you are far more likely to come across somebody that needs or has a mental health crisis than you are of someone, you know, having a physical crisis of other types.
Yeah, well, 25% of the population, treated, untreated, diagnosed, undiagnosed. So they're out there.
Yeah. Well, Frank, what other tips, hints, or helpful advice do you have for our listeners? And how can we learn more about you specifically?
Well, my website is TheMentalHealthComedian.com. TheMentalHealthComedian.com. That's also my business Facebook page, my Instagram, my Twitter. And let me give you my phone number. I'm going to say it. You can leave it in the recording.
Okay.
Because I put it up on the screen every time I keynote.
Okay.
It's 858-405-5653. 858-405-5653. The reason I put it up on the screen at my keynotes is, I said, look, if you're suicidal, call the hotline.
Mm-hmm.
If you are lifeline, if you are just having a really bad day, you're man, you have mental illness, call a crazy person. Because like me, because we're not going to be judgmental. We're just going to do what I recommend. We're just going to listen. And as a friend of mine says, we're just going to co-sign your BS.
Sure.
You know, just go, oh my God, oh Lord, I can't believe it. Oh, how? So, and a guy called me one time. He goes, man, I can't believe this is really your cell phone number. And I said, dude, how bad would the karma be for me to put a fake number up on the screen offering help to people who are depressed and perhaps suicidal?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I can make it worse. Here's where the comic kicks in. I can make it worse. Hold, please. And then the on-hold music would be another one bites the dust.
Another one down. Goodness gracious, guys.
Yeah. So that's my cell phone number. Please put it in the show notes.
I will.
Or they can email me by way of the website, or they can Facebook message me or whatever. Because, you know, people have questions about their loved ones, about themselves. And, you know, it's easier to start up a conversation with somebody they know gets it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because we speak a different language. I had a woman come up to me at Lynchburg College. She goes, can I give you a hug? I go, well, you know, this is right in the middle of the Me Too movement. Everybody in the room's got a phone with a camera in it. And I'm thinking, I can see the picture on the front page of the Lynchburg paper. 63-year-old speaker gropes co-ed. So I gave her a very brotherly, you know, let me hold my pelvis back hug. And I said to her, are you a hugger? And she goes, no, I don't hug. I said, well, why the hug? She goes, well, I've been in therapy for 2 years, and my therapist is very good. Clinically, she is superb. She's got all the book learning. And she goes, I'm sitting in the back of the room, and 5 minutes into you talking, I'm thinking, oh, my God, this guy is inside my head. She said, your 45 minutes did more for me than 2 years of therapy with a clinician who has no context.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It is. That's wonderful that you could reach people that way.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Thank you. And let me make one more recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Peer-to-peer counseling, family-to-family counseling is also good for that reason. And there's a group called NAMI, N-A-M-I, National Alliance Mental Illness, N-A-M-I. They've got chapters in just about every county in the country. They do peer counseling, family-to-family counseling. They've got all kinds of resources, classes for, if you got a child with schizoaffective disorder, they got a 12-week class once a week to help you learn how to help them. And here's the best part about NAMI. Everything they do, everything is free.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, because it's a volunteer-driven organization. The executive director and usually an admin are paid, and everybody else is volunteer.
Okay.
Very nice.
We need more groups like that, more people like you, and the world would be a much nicer place to live in.
And starting young. Start young and keep an eye on the youth.
But don't forget about the elderly.
Yeah, but, you know, start young.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, they've got their whole lives ahead of them. Try to get the mental health under control when they're young so that they have some tools that they need in order to survive this crazy mixed up world that we're in.
Yeah, and start in middle school. For example, if you can catch schizophrenia or schizoaffective in middle school, the outcomes in the long term are far better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess the more we all know about it.
Well, kids, I gotta get off the boat.
That's thank okay. You. Hey, congratulations! He's getting off the boat. All right.
Wonderful. It was so nice to speak with you, and we hope to hear from you again soon. And we look forward to buying your book.
Yes, we will definitely be buying that book.
Well, and one last question, and this is my two co-authors, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas and Sarah Gare, and we have a dozen contributors. We're going to do 4 volumes, 12 contributors, men, per book. If you have any interest in having Sally on or Sarah on or one of our contributors with a particular problem on,
right?
They would love to, you know, guess.
Absolutely.
And if you want to put you in touch with Sally and Sarah.
That would be great.
Thank you. Okay. And we're really glad that you made it back safely and healthy and... lots of love from us.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, my pleasure.
Happy Valentine's Day. Yeah, that was yesterday here in Cambodia. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's not a big holiday here in Cambodia.
Okay.
All right. Have a good one. Here. Have a good one, Frank.
Thanks,
guys.
Bye-bye.
If our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com through our website, podcastdx, on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram. And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. As always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this podcast. And if you feel that you're struggling, please seek immediate help.
1-800-273-8255.
It's here in the U.S. There are numbers in the U.K., in Australia, in Canada. There's always someone out there, and we care about you.
Yes, we do.
And we want you to be here another day.
Healthy and happy.
Yes.
See you on the next show.